Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. Our guest this week is a return guest. About 8 weeks ago, pre-corona though, we spoke with Max Eisenbud, head of WME's tennis division, agent for a number of players, including Maria Sharapova and Li Na, heavy hitter in tennis. This got a lot of really nice feedback. People appreciated Max's insights, some of his war stories, and we said we would do it again. And who knew that part two would come not much later, but in a very different era, in the corona era. So we speak a bit about what tennis is going through these days. Spoiler alert, Max is not optimistic about tennis returning in the near future. He is optimistic, though, about tennis long term, and especially this much discussed merger possibility, this combo between the ATP and WTA tours. So here is an interesting conversation with a guest we had on just a few weeks ago. Think of this as part two, but in a very different time. Here's Max.
It was about 8 weeks ago that we spoke, and people were very happy to have heard from you. We got nice reviews on this podcast, but it was it seems like about 8 years ago. It was a different era. We've had no tennis since the eve of Indian Wells, obviously. And it's hard to believe, A, that, and B, it was hard to believe at the time that was a controversial decision. I mean, give us, from where your perspective, I mean, give us a lay of the land. What are you seeing out there in terms of tennis?
This is a pretty humbling experience, I guess. We live in this, you know, amazing world of tennis, a little bubble that we travel the world to see these amazing cities. I think, you know, I've been in this business 20 years now, and I think, you know, if you take for granted how special it is to be able to go to Paris and Indian Wells and onto Wimbledon and just that whole tour. So for me personally, it's been a pretty, you know, eye opener of just how, you know, the fact that I'm not getting ready to think about heading to Europe now and all those kind of things is pretty humbling, and also allows you to really appreciate, you know, how lucky we are to be in this tennis world. So I think that's the first thing that's happened to me personally. But you know, as a client manager, as an agent, as a marketer, really your focus turns into your clients. And for us at IMG, and, you know, me running the tennis clients division, having, you know, maybe 120 clients between pros and juniors and legends, you know, the most important thing for us was, you know, information. And we set that up really fast, where we were having daily calls with all the agents, getting information I put a couple of my executives in responsible for one person was in charge of all information from the WTA. Another person was in charge of all information from the ATP. Another person from the ITF, and just gathering information as things was just moving so fast and so much hearsay, just trying to gather information and trying to educate our clients in real time, because I, you know, a lot of our clients were stuck in the United States. They didn't know, do I go home? Am I waiting for Miami? Are things going to close down? So it was, you know, there's no blueprint for this, and we just, you know, try to, try to do what's best for our clients and just get information. And I'm really proud of the team that we're able to, you know, get that information and try to make some good decisions for our clients. And that's really the most important thing, and continues every day. It's just not about doing the, you know, the huge Nike deals and generating money, but it's you're managing the client's life and their career. So that's kind of how we were doing it and continue to do it. But it's been crazy.
What are you seeing? I mean, obviously, you know, players play, and you and I can do our jobs, maybe not the same jobs we were doing, but, you know, we can still take our Zoom calls and work from home. That, when you're a professional athlete, that's not an option. I mean, what are you seeing with your clients, and what are the biggest challenges, apart from the obvious one of not playing and not having prize money as an income source? What else are you hearing?
Well, there was two phases, right? The first week or 2 weeks, maybe it was three. It's hard to tell now because everything's just, right. You know, it's one long day. You didn't realize how long this was going to be, when they're going to get back out there, when's the next tournament, is it going to be, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And then, so that there was a lot of anxiety in that time. Also, people were still trying to figure out where to go. Should we train? Should we not train? And then it came to the point where I think everybody knew, okay, this is going to be the long haul, and we need to get home to our families, or we need to get somewhere that's safe and where we can potentially train. So now we're in that second phase, and I think the anxiety of you know, where am I going, what am I going to do, is kind of worn off, and now I think everybody sees what's happening. Obviously, Indian Wells became a very good decision. And then the tournaments, once Miami, and it just kind of domino happened. So I think now you're in the phase of clients are getting antsy. Clients are getting bored. Clients don't know how hard to practice. Should we practice three times a week? There was a while where clients couldn't find courts, but eventually found private courts. I think it's safe to say that everybody found a court somewhere, somehow, if they wanted it. I find it hard to believe that someone couldn't find a private court somewhere. So I think now it's the balance of, you know, there's no finish line. We don't know when the next tournament is. So I think, you know, most of our clients that I hear are playing every other day, or every day for a short amount of time, just to keep muscle memory, keep the muscles going, technique, and then are doing some sort of gym work. So, yeah, I think that's kind of the phase we're in now. And I think, you know, a lot of people are starting to think that there's probably not going to be tennis in 2020.
Really?
And trying to wrap their heads around that.
Obviously, the U.S. Open wants to figure out a way to stage its event. The French Open, we know, is desperate to stage its event. They've moved to October. Do you think we get tennis again in 2020?
You know, I'm going to give you my honest opinion, and I really hope that I'm wrong. I'm wrong often, and I hope I'm wrong again. But, you know, it's really for me to see tennis on tour the rest of this year. And to be quite honest, it's hard for me to imagine tennis without a vaccine.
Really?
I mean, I just, it's hard for me to imagine, you know, 400 players from 80 different countries, you know, landing in a city and getting ready to compete. I really hope I'm wrong, but it just, it's hard for me to see it. It's scary.
You've heard I suspect you've heard some of the same creative solutions that I have. Maybe we don't have doubles. Maybe we don't have mixed doubles. Maybe if there are no fans, we can use all of the grounds. I even heard that at the U.S. Open, if there are no fans, the players could each use one of the corporate suites as a locker room. Are you skeptical of these creative solutions, or do you think there's some ways around some of this?
Skeptical. One thing is, all the tours have done an amazing job. I got to tell you, the leadership, especially on the ATP tour, I'm a big believer in those two guys and everybody pulling in the same direction, minus the French Open, but really the sport's really pulled in the same direction. And I've seen so much work and dedication of trying to salvage the year and tournaments moving into later dates. And I've seen it all. I've seen it on paper and it looks amazing. And if we do get that window, the players and the tennis fans are going to be really pleasantly surprised on how much work the tours have done as planned, A, B, C, D, and E.
Right.
I just don't think we get there, man. And I hope I'm wrong. I saw the other day where a country like Argentina is closing mm-hmm. their borders in and out until September. So how, if you have players that are in Argentina, the U.S. Open start, how does that happen? I just don't see it.
I mean, it's funny because in some ways tennis is so poorly positioned being such a global sport. And in other ways, you got two people on opposite sides of a net. At least you've got the social distancing during competition part. At least you've got that down. I want to ask you some more, because I think last time we talked, you had some really interesting insights about sort of inside agenting that people don't always think about. And one of them that I thought was really interesting was when you get to the semis of a major, various sponsors in the tour are already starting to strategize about what it would look like when you win. And you're trying to shield your client, and they've got to win two more matches, but you've also don't want to get caught flat-footed. So I got a couple more I want to ask you about. One of them is fashion. And when Maria Sharapova shows up with a new Nike dress to her night session at the U.S. Open, what's the backstory there? I mean, what goes on to make that happen?
Oh, that's a good question. Nike works 18 months in advance. So when any dress, if let's say we're using the U.S. Open, the start of that starts 18 months in advance. And Maria has her own line and her own collection that she wears. And then she has about six, she used to wear. She's retired now.
Could let you go in present tense.
So she used to have six or seven girls, young up-and-coming girls, that would also wear her collection, which is pretty unique. So Maria would work with the designers. There would be a head designer that was in charge of the Maria Sharapova collection, and Maria would start 18 months in advance. So Maria would, she did a lot of tears. So she'd, in her fashion magazine, she would tear the pages of dresses for inspiration. So she might see a dress that's on the runway somewhere. She tears it and she does a little sketching too. Our sketching's actually pretty good, but she never would let anyone see it. So a combination of the tears, some sketching, and then she would sit down with the Nike designers and be like, okay, can we bring this to the court? And a lot of times it would be no chance, or a lot of times it would be, yes, we can bring that to the court, but it would cost $750. Nobody's going to buy a dress. So what palettes, the color palettes that Nike's working with. Nike, people don't understand, but if you notice that the palettes that the tennis players are wearing, the three or four color scheme, is usually the same color scheme that their basketball, soccer, all their sports are. So you have to design in kind of a color scheme as well. So that process starts 18 months in advance, and she will probably see, I'd say, between 10 to 15 different versions of the dress before it gets, and then she has to play test it to make sure the sweat, and she can do all the different things. So it's a major haul for all that kind of stuff. And, Yeah, so and then the PR and the promotion around it and when she's going to debut it and how she's going to debut it. I mean, the amount of emails about how she's going to debut the dress. Is she doing it the Thursday before the Grand Slam on a PR event? Is she not doing any and just showing up on the court with it? Sometimes they would do dresses, like the night dress that she would do a collaboration with a designer, and then those dresses just – they can't make them for the masses, so only her dress was made, and it was a marketing play.
Right.
Then you'd get a lot of fans that are upset that they can't get the dress, but it just doesn't work. So, you know, there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of conversation, a lot of dialogue, and it's the reason why Nike's the best. They just capitalize on those moments so well.
What about the players that aren't Maria Sharapova? How does it work for player X who's might have a deal with Nike? Are they essentially sold? Listen, here's what we're rolling out for the French Open. You got to wear this. Is there any sort of input, and is there any right of refusal?
Okay, so like let's say a player like Madison Keys, who's
good example. Yeah,
yeah, Madison. So what Nike usually has is three lines, and then Sharapova's line is a fourth line. And then the players would all be broken down into those three lines. So let's say, I don't know what they call it, but whatever they call the three lines, Keys and seven or eight other players are always in that line. And Kvitova and seven or eight other players are in that line. So they pretty much stay in that same line all the time. And there's usually not too much flexibility.
Let me ask you this. You said last time that you started out, I think Max Murney was an early client of yours. How did you end up switching so the majority of your clients are female? What challenges are there with that? And what in your personality sort of, how'd you make that choice?
Well, I think it all came from Maria, to be honest with you. Maria opened up doors. Maria, her success brought me probably a lot of power and control on the WTA tour. My relationships were there, knew the game, knew the scheduling. And so I think Maria is the one who opened up a lot of the opportunities. I mean, I signed Madison Keys when she's 12 years old because I managed Maria Sharapova.
How different is it managing female players versus managing male players?
I mean, obviously there's some difference of the, you know, of the emotion and everything. But, you know, there's no cookie cutter. You know, the things that I've managed Maria is different than Lina, different than Madison. You know, I managed Jack Sock. Everybody's different. You know, there's obviously, you know, the guys take the losses a little better than the women. Just the normal stuff you would say, the difference between a male and a female. But at the end of the day, I consider myself a marketer. I'm a brand builder, and that's what I like doing. You know, and if that's a male tennis player or a female tennis player, or you know,
right,
a can of paint. You know, I love that part of the business, and I don't think that sees male or female when you're marketing or building a brand.
Are you watching the Jordan documentary?
I have purposely waiting so I can binge watch it.
Oh man! All right, I'm gonna play spoiler for one little part.
Okay.
That Jordan is with David Falk at ProServe.
Yep.
And they talk to Nike and how are we going to build a brand around this guy? And they say, you're trying to make this guy a tennis player. And sure enough, ProServe had represented Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith and whoever else. And, you know, clearly the template from Donald Dell and David Falk was a tennis player, was sort of a tennis player template. Do you see yourself taking these skills from Maria and Madison Keys and these experience with international athletes? I mean, why not do this for basketball players? Why are you restricting yourself to tennis?
I mean, I tried to dabble a little bit with some other sports. I mean, first of all, I played tennis. I went to college on a tennis scholarship. I loved the sport. I played the sport. And the one thing I love about tennis is, especially when you have your star players, you know, 80% of their income is on off the court. And a basketball player or a football player, 80% of their income is on the field.
Right, right.
So the agent and those other team sports, I mean, okay, take, you know, I know LeBron and those other guys have a lot of businesses going on, but for the most part, the ratio of on the court and off the court, it's really the agent, its job. And the one thing, you know, the agent has a lot of control and influence in how you're building a brand and the decisions you're making in tennis. I like that. And I've been lucky enough to work with some players that have really trusted me and have really put their off-court stuff in my hands and said, listen, I'm going to focus, you know, on the court, and I really want you to focus off the court. And yes, I'll make the final decisions, but I'm going to trust the path that you're on. And that's been very attractive. And I've been very lucky. Not all agents have that. And in our sport, you can see the players that don't have great agents around them.
Right,
It's glaring.
How?
You can see it, I mean, in simple stuff. I mean, it surprises me how many really good players in this day of age have really bad social media. Like, social media is as important as your forehand and your serve. I mean, and you've got to, if you want to have deals, if you want to have relationships, if you want to, you know, so just little things like that. It's just, it's hard to see.
Tell me about the breakup. I mean, I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize this. I mean, we've all watched Entourage, but I mean, I'm always surprised by how often it's the agency saying, you know, I'm not sure what I can do for you. I've taken you as far as I can take you, or sort of crassly, you know, I'm devoting a lot of time here and I'm not seeing the return on investment. What's the breakup process like, both agent parting with client and client parting with agent?
I think, again, there's no cookie cutter there. I mean, there's clients that I signed, and, you know, I have a client, Ayla Tomlanovich, who I've been managing since she's 13 or 14 years old. She's ranked 50 in the world. And I just have such, I mean, she's like part of my family, you know, and I could never see, she'll probably fire me tomorrow, but I can never see me not working with her, you know, and trying to set up for her life after tennis and getting her in different things. And, you know, last year we moved her from Nike to K-Swiss and because there were some revenue opportunities there. And okay, these deals weren't huge, but I was so proud and so happy to make these deals for her. And I still think she's got a chance to, you know, she should be ranked much higher and she's very marketable, but I don't know. I don't put like a, I try when I sign the players, I want to manage them for life and I want to get her through tennis and into other opportunities. And, you know, I care about her and work for her as much as I do for Maria or Lena. And I don't know how other agents do it.
Right.
But for
right.
me, you know, I have a young client, Amelia Arango from Colombia. I signed her when she was 13 or 14. So marketable, so much flair. Just a great girl. Had hip surgery, struggling. Maybe she's 400 or 500 in the world. But she's like, she's part of my family, and I work for her, and I try to do things for her. But for me, when I sign a player, it's really genuine. Like, I'm signing the player because I really believe in them. I really believe in their character, their marketability. And if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But I'm not going to never go to a client and be like, listen, I'm sorry, I thought you were going to be 20 in the world. You know, if they're 300 or 400 in the world, there's not much you can do for them, but you can help them. My office is still helping them get to tournaments, helping them do this, helping them with their funding,
right,
helping them get their rackets. So, you know, so one call I'm on the call doing a multi-million-dollar deal for Lena, and the next call, you know, I'm trying to beg Nike to please keep giving free product to my client.
And you're okay with that?
Yeah, I am.
Let me ask you one more question. It seems like the big off-season news, apart from whether tennis will continue and what it will look like, is this idea that Roger Federer didn't necessarily come up with, but he floated and gave some credibility to, about combining tours. What do you think of that proposal? Could it work? Do you want it to work?
That's a good question. I mean, listen, I've made my living in women's tennis, and I always want what's good for women's tennis. But let me back up and say this. I think the most interesting and the best thing that's happened to tennis in a long time is the two new hires at the ATP Tour, and Andre and Massimo. I'm privy to a lot of their plans, and I think a lot of this conversation is because of those two guys' vision for the ATP and the WTA to do more together. And that's where I think a lot of this is coming from, is their vision.
What do you think their motivation is?
Their only motivation is to make tennis better. And finally, we have two savvy guys who have a real plan. We haven't had that in a long time. Not afraid to lose their jobs. Haven't had that in a long time.
Right.
And I think these two guys are going to do some amazing things for our sport that we've needed. So I think they are the two that have started this conversation, because they've come in and said, hey, we want to start doing some more stuff with the women. And I don't know, I haven't heard that from the ATP in a long time. Now, do I think that those two mean let's join tours? I don't think so. Maybe not now for the short term, but right. I think what they mean is let's try to pool our TV rights. Let's try to pool some marketing. Let's try to have some more bigger combined events. Let's make it easier for the tennis world to watch our sport. Let's stop being so fragmented. Let's stop being so selfish. So for the first time in a long time, you have these two guys on the men's side who are saying these things. It's never, I mean, in my 20 years, I can't remember anybody at the ATP saying those things. Maybe the timing was right, that the people were ready to do that. Maybe they trust these two guys, that they actually came with a real plan. But they're really smart. And I think they're the story. Those two guys are the story for our tennis right now, and the two guys that everybody should be watching. And I think that if everybody in our tennis world, including the people that wear the ING hats and the people that wear the octagon hats and all these, if everyone can just try to become a little uncomfortable and follow these guys, I think we can get our sport to place that it hasn't been in a while. I mean, Massimo, I've worked with at Nike and Wilson, and know how he works, and just a really smart guy. And
you're talking, let's just be clear, you're talking about Calvelli and Andrea Godenzi, the two new chief executives of men's tennis, right?
Yes. Right. I think those two guys are the story. And again, if everyone can just get a little uncomfortable and try to follow these guys' leads, I think tennis is going to has a chance. And if that ends in 5 years, that the two tours are together, that would be great.
Right.
I think people think that that's going to happen tomorrow. And I'm reading some of this stuff. It's not happening tomorrow. Okay. But let's just be happy that we have two guys in leadership that understand the value of the women's tennis and understand how fragmented our sport is, and understand that if we're going to just keep going down the same path of, oh, I want to make changes, but don't touch my tournament or right. don't touch my interest. Right. I think we've got something special in these two guys that can really help our sport and respect what's happening on the women's side.
I like that. All right, you depressed me with your speculation. There's no tennis until there's a vaccine, but you've given me some uplift with the prospect of two tours combining for the betterment of the sport. That's a good good place to end it. But that's two good things to think about.
Well, I preface it that I said I'm usually wrong, so maybe I'll continue my streak.
So we'll have tennis in July, and men's and women's will be fighting. This was great. This again, we did this like totally different era 2 months ago, and people really responded to it. So I was glad we were able to pick this up. I wish the circumstances were better, but this was a pleasure.
All right, John, anytime.
All right, thanks. Take care of yourself.
Bye-bye.
All right, thanks to our guest, Max Eisenbud, for coming on for part two of our discussion. Good of him to spend some time with us. And we also have a special treat. Jamie Lisanti is back. Jamie, nice to connect with you again. It's been a while.
It has been a while. We have still no studio. We still cannot sit across from each other at the table, but I'm here and I'm excited to be here.
We are excited to talk again. We'll deal with Skype and Zoom if we have to. It will be nice to reconnect in person. How are you? How are you experiencing this? How are you handling this?
I'm all right. I'm hanging in like everyone. You know, there's been a lot to do here at SI, even though we don't have sports. But I'm doing all right. I am staying home, grocery store every 10 days. I actually hurt my back, so I've been trying to be on the mend there, but it's all good.
I'm sorry to hear that. It is funny how there are no sports, and yet in a lot of ways, our jobs are as busy as ever. But I think we're all for a variety of reasons, we're all looking forward to games resuming. Let me ask you, you are much younger than I am. You still have time to make a career shift. Would you like to be a tennis agent? Did hearing Max make you rethink your vocational choices?
He is very candid about the process. And I thought it was interesting how he shed some light on, you know, your questions were great. He shed some light on how the dresses for, you know, Sharapova or for Madison Keys, you know, things like that are kind of just interesting to hear the backstory. I mean, it's a lot of business speak and things like that, but it's certainly interesting to just hear how all that comes together and how much time that takes to come together. He does have a very interesting job. You know, I respect that he thinks and treats his clients like family. But one thing, you know, that I thought was interesting that he said was his one comment about social media nowadays being as important as your forehand and your serve. When you asked him about what makes agents better than others, or, you know, which tennis players don't have the expertise in that part of their lives. And so I thought that was interesting just because I still think that athletes don't understand that in many ways. You know, there are still people who use it just as a carefree outlet. And I think, you know, especially even in my life, like professionally, I've just seen how much it really needs to be a reflection of you that you would like to present even in your workplace, you know, as sad or as, you know, unfortunate as that may be. So I thought that was an interesting comment from him.
You know, it's funny. I was struck by that too. And it also strikes me that the one thing I never understand about social media is the risk reward ratio. That if I tweet something out and it gets, you know, thousands of retweets, you get a little chemical rush, but I don't get a dime out of that. It's not really worth much to me financially. If I tweet something objectionable, in theory, I could lose my job. So as a risk reward proposition for most of us, I'm not sure social media pans out so well. On the other hand, if you are Maria Sharapova, it's much different. I mean, there is real, this could be a real revenue source too. I mean, Jeannie Bouchard is sort of the classic example of someone who makes a lot of money, not because she's winning tennis matches, but because she has this social media following and presence and personality. So apart from sort of like, I hate this word brand extension, but I think there are examples in tennis where social media for a player is dollars and cents, and it can be a real source of income, which means that if you don't do it well, I mean, you know, it took Roger Federer years and years to get on social media himself. Now he seems to enjoy it, but also, you know, in some ways you are depriving yourself of income if you ignore or neglect social media as a professional athlete. So I thought that was interesting too.
I think Cristiano Ronaldo is someone who totally exemplifies that. I mean, I'm pretty sure, I think I read something and this was something I wanted to just look into generally. He reportedly makes more money for, you know, posts on Instagram than he does playing soccer. Paid Instagram posts for him literally put food on the table more than what he is so gifted at, you know, in his sport. It's just incredible that an athlete can do that. And to your point, I mean, like Jeannie Bouchard is a great one. It's an amazing differentiator that athletes from years ago just didn't have to deal with. And now it's almost no question that if you, you know, if you don't have an Instagram or you don't have a Twitter, it's like, why? You almost have to like have a stance.
Right. Or use it as a, you know, just be a lurker. But I mean, you know, I still think for people like us, I just see a lot of people diminishing themselves or having to apologize or wasting bandwidth getting into a Twitter feud. And I'm sort of thinking, what, why? But it's much different if you are if you are an athlete. I think I fact checked this, but even like I saw Jerry on Cheer. Did you watch Cheer, Jamie?
Yes, I did. Actually, after all we talked about it, I went and I watched Tiger King and Cheer just so that we could talk about it.
can we go Ozark for the trifecta?
Oh, no, that's all the one. That's the next one. That's the next one.
I mean, Michael Jordan's a given, but no, I was going to say that Jerry from Cheer, I saw recently makes, you know, $1,500 per sponsored post. So it's not just Roger Federer and Cristiano Ronaldo, but let me ask you something else just sort of about where you are with tennis these days. And there is, I think tennis is in a very strange position where on the one hand, the act of hitting a tennis ball over a net when you are, you know, 20 yards away from the opponent is in keeping with social distancing. And yet it's pretty obvious that tennis has some real challenges about reconvening. A lot of different discussions, a lot of proposals on the table. Wimbledon said, we're out. The French Open and the US Open have been a little bit more stubborn. Of course, they do not have the benefit of, you know, the nine-figure insurance policy that the All England Club has. But what, where are you on tennis returning, and what has struck you about a lot of these discussions that are going on?
Yesterday, the 2021 Australian Open said that it could be impacted, you know, by the pandemic. Craig Tiley said that yesterday. So I am sort of with what Max said, that unfortunately, I don't know if it's possible without a vaccine, without some sort of, I think it's possible, but there will be so many differences that it'll be hard to consider a Grand Slam in the same way, have the same weight. Should it be, you know, worth the same amount of points? Should people make the same money? If all of those factors that make a Grand Slam so grand, you know, for lack of a better word, aren't there. The idea of doubles and mixed doubles and all the other stuff that happens besides just the, you know, 128 players in the main draw, that the fans and the way that, you know, the players that attend that. I mean, if, you know, like you guys are talking about with Max, if players from Argentina or players from the US or from certain countries aren't allowed to attend, all of a sudden now you're not opening it up to all the best players in the world, right? So how can you say that that French Open title or that Australian Open title is just as validated as a title from a previous year where it was open to everyone and any, you know, the best of the best competed and they, you know, found a winner that way. I just think it's going to be really difficult given how many people are involved and how many people attend a tennis match. I mean, you've been to the US Open, I've been to the US Open. Social distancing is not possible with the amount of fans and people and workers that happen there. I know that you had a different scenarios for the US Open that you outlined your mailbag, but do you think that the fanless, you know, no audience tennis is a real option here?
I think it beats the alternative. And I think whether it's WWE or UFC or, you know, Korean baseball, we're sort of getting a glimpse that it's possible. I mean, it's different. It's not ideal. The athletes themselves, I mean, I was joking sort of, who are you pumping your fist to if there's nobody
right
in the stands? But I think, I mean, I don't, would, let me ask you this. Would you, and then I'll keep monologuing, but would you go to a sporting event right now? Would you go to the US, if I gave you tickets, would you go to the US Open if it were held?
No, I don't think so. The same goes for what I get on a train to
exactly.
That I have to get to go to the office, you know?
Right. Would you go to the movies? I mean, I think it's going to be a long time before people are comfortable. I mean, I think some of this is just simple economics, right? I mean, ESPN pays $80 million plus for U.S. Open broadcast rights. Even without trying to get a reduction, which I think is a very real possibility, prize money is about, you know, whatever it is, $55 million, roughly $60 million. So ESPN alone, without a sponsorship, without talking about Eurosport, without anything, a tennis channel, without anything else, ESPN's already covered your prize money. So I think from a dollars and cents point, even if you don't make a dime in ticket revenue this year, you'll still make a little bit of profit if you figure out a way to hold the event. I think the question is, how do you do this with an international sport? I think this issue that you raised about if the U.S. Open isn't really open and Argentina is saying you can't come, you can't leave the country, and Diego Schwartzman and Del Potro don't get to play, I don't know if players are going to have to come here and quarantine first. I mean, there are a lot of, I mean, I think that was something that Craig Tiley had mentioned too. I mean, he sort of said worst case scenario is there's no 2021 Australian Open, but we've sort of identified this as four different scenarios. It did seem like the most, and I had someone had texted me saying this as well. It seems like the most likely one right now in mid-May, you know, eight months away, is that there is an Australian Open. The players may have to quarantine before playing, which is A, strange, and B, I don't know what that does for the ATP Cup that this year preceded the Australian Open. But also the fans are only allowed to come if they are from either Melbourne or Victoria, the state. And basically, your international event is not open to international fans. It's all very strange. I'll tell you the strangest one I've heard so far is that there's real concern over the locker room. Even if you don't have fans in the stands, how do you have, and Max made this point as well, how do you have players from scores of countries with their own, you know, with everyone's got a team, and even if there are no doubles players, mixed doubles, legends, juniors, you still have hundreds and hundreds of people milling around from all over the world. One thing I had heard is if you don't have fans, you have access to the entire grounds of the U.S. Open. It may be that there could be dozens and dozens of locker rooms. You could use corporate suites as locker rooms. You could use, you know, the catering facilities as places where players could change. And basically what you would have is, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of players scattered all over the grounds with different changing areas and different locker rooms to avoid hundreds of people in one space. So, I mean, again, I think this is, you know, we've all gotten nimble, right? I mean, this is you and I doing a podcast over Zoom, and this is where I am right now in Connecticut. There's a distillery that stopped making alcohol, and they're now making hand sanitizer. I mean, everyone has, at some level, had to improvise, but boy, I think tennis has a tall order here.
Yeah, it's really going to be tough. And that closed door scenario, just, you know, there again, like you say, the locker rooms, the bathrooms, where the players eat, where are they going to practice? I mean, there are so many things that you and I, you know, obviously remote working now is the new norm, right? As you say, we're on this Zoom call now. So obviously, a lot of companies are probably reconsidering their Manhattan offices or their San Francisco offices because everyone's doing business as usual, you know, remotely. So I think, you know, all of our lives are going to change on the other side of this, and tennis will be the same, but it's a much more difficult scenario than just saying, oh, you can, you know, you can now work from home 3 days a week because we've proven, right? I mean, this is a competition. This is, you know, there are people who have jobs that are solely to, you know, organize an event that they might not be needed anymore. I mean, taking temperatures before matches. There's just so many things, you know, we think about blowing the candles out on a birthday cake. You know, I saw something on social media the other day that like, oh, we used to eat the cake after somebody made their wish, you know? And it's like, there's just so many small things like that that are not going to be the same anymore. You know, I don't know how many people will be eating birthday cake after somebody made their wish. And I don't know how many people are going to want to go as a fan to an event, and as a player, how much are you willing to risk? And I think then you start really, again, it brings the level of a Grand Slam tournament or any tournament down when You know, you have some players who just say, I don't feel comfortable, right. You know, or I'm a high risk. I'm more at risk here. And it's just such a complicated situation.
I'll tell you one, in the spirit of blowing out a birthday cake and then eating it, which now that you say it, it's really disgusting. John Oliver had a riff about bowling, which is the same way. Hey, we're all going to like stick our strangers are going to stick their fingers in these balls that we're then going to. The other one, I think in tennis that is a mercifully that I think we should all celebrate as a casualty is the ball kid picking up the like snot soaked, sweat soaked towel. I don't know if you've seen now. I mean, they're not even the players are playing these exhibition matches and they're tapping rackets. They're not even shaking hands. I think the ball boy is towel boy is thankfully going to be relegated. I mean, the other thing too that I think is something that's a little distasteful, but we all need to talk about is just the visuals of this. And you know, I think Louisa Thomas wrote this that the National Tennis Center is like 2 miles from this Elmhurst Hospital. It's basically ground zero for coronavirus, where you have these refrigerated trucks that are hauling out the deceased bodies. It's a little strange Labor Day weekend to be 2 miles away from that amid all this devastation, this economic ruin, and sit there in a corporate suite, you know, drinking one of those, the honey deuce and eating your lobster roll. I mean, I think that from a sensitivity stance, it was sort of like the post for corona version of the spring break kid in Daytona. I mean, you don't want to be the guy in a corporate suite 2 miles away from where they're still hauling out dead bot. I mean, I think there's an optics PR component to this that probably needs to be considered too.
We talk about all these changes, but the biggest one that has been getting some, I guess, serious consideration, maybe not for implementation, you know, this year or next year, but the merger of the WTA and ATP tours. You wrote about this a little bit and it's been a hot topic, but realistic, unrealistic. Max also mentioned it on this pod. Do you feel like it's something that will get some consideration going forward now that we might have this long layoff from tennis?
I think it's all about terms and conditions, and it makes all the sense in the world. And this is something, you know, Billie Jean King floated this decades ago. I think tennis is at its strongest, not just as a product, not just sort of spiritually, but in the marketplace, when it goes to networks, when it goes to sponsors, when it's men and women. And I think it's no secret that the biggest events and the best events and the most successful events are mixed gendered. I think it's great when, hey, Nadal won in a blowout, but luckily we can go to court six where Coco Gauff is playing, you know, Naomi Osaka, which wouldn't be on court six. But I think it's a great hedge when sometimes you have matches that don't sing and sometimes you have matches that do. I think it's a nice sign that tennis can accommodate men and women. It brings in a bigger variety of fans. I mean, they're all things going for it. The hitch in all this is that the ATP and the WTA are two different businesses right now with two different valuations in the market. And the big question is, you know, somebody wrote to me, they said that, you know, it's a merger is never a merger, that two law firms come together and one of them brings in more business than the other, and they have to figure out how to, you know, how to distribute the partner equity. I think it's all about what this is going to look like. And do you pay equal prize money if the men bring in fewer sponsorships? Do they get equal pay and vice versa? I think a lot of this sort of depends on concessions that are willing to be made. Inevitably, some people won't be happy, but I think if you just hammer home this message that 1+1=3, and that whatever nickels you might be giving up because you can prove that your sponsorships are more valuable, if you can convince those people that, hey, look, we're all going to benefit much more from this union than leaving a couple of shekels on the table for if you have equal pay, I think that's really critical. So I mean, the short answer is I think it's great. I think there's a lot of potential there, but I think it's going to take some creative deal making. Let me ask you, I mean, you know, one thing I was thinking about this, and I wanted to ask you, especially as a D1 soccer player, have you been following this lawsuit with the women's national team in USA Soccer?
Of course.
Thoughts on the summary judgment last week? And I'm teeing you up to make a broader point, but I mean, I don't know. What did you think? What did you experience when you heard about this decision in California Central District?
Appeal. Mm-hmm. those are the first thoughts. I mean, it's just concerning, honestly, on all parts. And the fact that these women are going to keep fighting is just really great. And I think that people have, you know, people not in the sport have really shown that they're going to support that fight. So wasn't happy about it, to say the least.
Yeah. And I thought, I mean, I'm with you. And I thought about this through the lens of, as I often do, through the lens of tennis, mm-hmm. which is there are real PR consequences to some of these decisions being made. And if this merger were to happen, but you had a situation like this where sort of women were demonstrably paid less and paid under market value and even made a deal, negotiated a deal that later they would come to regret, even if that was done in the spirit of collective bargaining, there are real PR consequences to screwing this up. And so when Roger Federer tweets this out and Rafa follows and a number of other players and Petra Kvitova applauds, I think that's great. I think this makes a lot of sense. I think it's a really good time for tennis to consider this. But I think people need to remember that getting this wrong, as we're seeing with women's soccer, getting this wrong has some real consequences in the marketplace. So it's easy to send a tweet and then send a retweet. And I'm glad that Billie Jean King is getting the credit she deserves here. But this thing really needs to be handled sensibly, delicately, and in a way that makes people happy. Because if this thing goes sideways, as we're seeing in soccer, it's really, really a bad look. So that's my sort of hopeful optimism / caveat on this issue.
For sure. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, there's just so many different factors of that. I mean, we could have a whole nother podcast just about the U.S. Women's National Team and that whole legal process and total catastrophe that everything happened. But I agree. I think that, you know, as Max said, the merging of the tours or even the explicit details of that it's not something that's going to come tomorrow or even next year. It's going to take some time. But the fact that people are entertaining it, you know, I think people are doing a lot of different things now with a little bit more time on their hands to reflect and, you know, look at the bigger picture of things. And hopefully that's beneficial for tennis in this way.
I was thinking with Max too. I mean, right now it's a given. I mean, I always say nobody says, oh, I love the Williams sisters, but who's that guy from Spain who is the lefty who's really good on clay? Nobody says, oh, I love Roger Federer. And who are those sisters from, you know, from Southern California who have won all the majors? I mean, fans like men and women's tennis. Fans follow men and women's tennis. It was a big deal when it happened in the NBA and in baseball. Well, you know what? We have females as chair umpires for men's matches and vice versa. It goes on without a peep. We even have agents that represent players on the men's tour and the women's tour. I mean, tennis is so integrated in a way we don't even think about, in a way that's great. Again, this makes all the sense in the world. I just think it really needs to be handled delicately, because the minute you have a situation like USA Soccer, the minute fans are yelling, you know, equal pay at tennis matches, we're in a bad place. So tread carefully. Let me ask you one more thing. No matches, obviously, since, you know, effectively since February, since the first week of March. A lot of tennis news. We've been talking about this proposed combo of tours, but there's been plenty of other news. Some of this is dates and rescheduling. We've had fun stories. We've had, I don't know if you've seen the two brothers, the two little kids with the one-handed backhands, and we've had the backboard challenge. Give me your favorite piece of tennis news or marginalia in these last 8 weeks, Jamie.
I'm going to call out a coworker here, our friend Stanley Kay, who, you know, people who are on SI.com may know very well. But I was scrolling, you know, through my feed, and I saw this you know, video about people in New York, and they were just on their rooftops kind of hanging out, spending their time. You know, some people were working out, some people were, you know, jump roping, some people were picnicking, enjoying a glass of wine, whatever it was. And there was this one guy who was hitting the tennis ball against the wall, and and practicing his serve. And I said, you know, that guy looks really familiar. I think I might sit next to him at work when we were in the office.
Really?
Sure enough, Stanley Kay was, you know, caught on tape in New York City on his Brooklyn rooftop practicing tennis, you know, doing Roger Federer's challenge. And I think he even got the little retweet from Federer. You mentioned the challenges or, you know, tennis players kind of having some fun at home during this quarantine time. But I think that's my favorite part, is just these, you know, these little fun stories. That was something for me that, you know, I don't see Stanley anymore. We certainly don't have tennis anymore, but it was just like a nice heartwarming moment where I was like, oh, wow, very, very cool for him. And, you know, it got all over the internet and retweeted, but it was fun.
I can't believe I missed that. by the way,
that's a very personal tennis story, but
you want Stanley Kay trivia. He is from the clan of what former top 10 player? Do you know that?
Yes, I do, because of U.S. Open stories that we've
run. Very good, very good. Aaron Krickstein for our listeners.
You can Google that and read all about it. I think he's wrote about it a few times for SI.
Oh, that's a great, you'll have to include that clip in our show page. All right, this has been great. Let's do another one of these next week, perhaps.
Let's do it. I think we've figured out the Zoom studio here.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
I'll call him out and say, God bless Max Eisenbud. And he's a great guest, but we had some technical challenges on that front as well. But hopefully the content overcame the audio quality. So anyway, thanks, Jamie. This was great. Nice chatting as always.
Same to you. Stay safe, stay home. And we'll talk soon.
You as well. All right. That does it for this week. Thanks everyone for listening. Hope everyone is safe, hanging in there spiritually as well as physically. And we will do it again next week. You can subscribe, leave a review, feel free to send guest suggestions, and we'll talk in 7 days. Take care, everyone.